Sadly, that's the way, and that's the way this world works now. It's all materialistic. There's no humanity left in it. Where if we go back in Islam, the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he says, go back to your roots, go back to your nature, and deal with one another based on love, mercy, and compassion. We'll leave it here. We will continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صلِّ يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
In the limelight.
A bomb attack claimed by Daesh terrorist group on a Shia mosque in Afghanistan's northeastern city of Kunduz has martyred more than 50 people and left scores of others injured. We now present you an article written by Sayed Zafar Mahdi, a Tehran-based journalist, editor and blogger with over 10 years of experience. The piece is titled Daesh War on Hazara Shias in Taliban's Afghanistan. The deadly spiral of violence targeting Afghanistan's long-repressed religious and ethnic minority, Hazara Shias, continues unabated. From the notorious Pashtun ruler Abdulrahman Khan in the late 1880s to the Daesh terrorist group in the 21st century, this vulnerable group has known nothing but violence and death, and everything in between. The juggernaut ruled again recently during Friday, 8th of October congressional prayers in the northern city of Kunduz in Afghanistan. A young suicide bomber masquerading as one of the worshippers detonated his explosives during prayers, leaving a trail of death and destruction. The devastating attack followed a strikingly familiar pattern which has come to define the terrorist group's modus operandi in Afghanistan since 2014. When it first made inroads into the war-ravaged country. More than 100 casualties have been reported from Friday's high-intensity bombing at Guzar-e-Sayyedabad Mosque in Khanabad area of the city of Kunduz, with a predominantly Hazara population. The toll is likely to mount, as many have been admitted to hospitals in a critical condition. Video footage shared on social media showed heartbreaking scenes inside and outside of the mosque, with disfigured bodies scattered throughout the debris. One video showed a distraught mother wailing over the body of her young son. Not much remained of his lifeless body, though. There were other extremely graphic images, too, with body parts hanging from the ceiling inside the mosque and plumes of smoke rising from the burning structure outside. The blood and tears were indistinguishable. Eyewitnesses and survivors described the apocalyptic scenes in the aftermath of the bombing, with ambulances ferrying the dead and people frantically searching for their missing relatives. Muhammad Imran, a local resident and eyewitness, said, "All I could see was blood and body parts and frightened people standing numb, not knowing the fate of their friends and relatives." At least three of his friends were martyred in the bombing, and many are still missing. One eyewitness said his father was critically wounded in the tragic incident, but had no information about some of his friends who went to the mosque on that day. Hadi cried, "It feels like doomsday, everything seems to be over," adding, "What did we do to deserve this? Why do they keep snatching our loved ones from us?" Zaki Daryabi, chief editor of Kabul-based newspaper Ittilaat, said a woman who lived in the neighborhood for 2 years had 23 people in her immediate family either martyred or injured in the deadly blast. Zaki Daryabi shared pictures of some young victims who had been identified by their families and a video showing people digging mass graves in an open field. Pointing to poor services, he said many people had succumbed to their wounds due to a lack of medicine. Local sources said that hospitals and dispensaries were teeming with patients. The trauma center run by Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders in Kunduz, had treated more than 100 wounded people since many others were brought martyred to the hospital. It's important to recall that on 3rd of October 2015, the U.S. occupation forces had bombed this same hospital, killing at least 42 people, including innocent women and children. Scores of patients were charred to death and many others were badly decapitated in a horrendous war crime that largely went unnoticed. The latest diabolical attack, reminiscent of the October 2015 bomb attack, is among the deadliest terrorist attacks in Afghanistan since the U.S.-led invasion of the country in 2001, and the first since the Taliban announced a caretaker government in Kabul recently. The last time Daesh terrorists mounted an attack was immediately after the Taliban sweeping takeover of the country and the US-led coalition's hasty and humiliating retreat outside Kabul's Hamid Karzai International Airport in mid-August, killing over 160 civilians. In recent weeks, there have been intermittent attacks on Taliban militants in eastern Nangarhar province, the Daesh stronghold, and the two groups step up their long-running rivalry in the volatile Afghan-Pakistan region. Experts see Friday, 8th of October bomb attack serving multiple purposes for Daesh Takfiri terrorists, to undermine the Taliban's newly established rule and to continue its long-running murderous campaign aimed at ethnically cleansing the minority Hazara Shia community from Afghanistan, which it has long seen as part of the resistance front in Syria and Iraq. In a statement after the attack, the terrorist group said the suicide bomber detonated his explosive vest amid a crowd of Hazara Shia worshippers inside the mosque. The explicit mention of Hazara was striking. The group vowed to continue targeting the vulnerable Hazara Shia community, who constitute roughly 15 to 20% of Afghanistan's population. In Kunduz, they make up about 6% of the 1 million population. Since Friday, social media have been flooded with evocative messages expressing solidarity with the persecuted Hazara community and warning against Afghanistan becoming another Syria. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has called on Afghanistan's authorities to punish the perpetrators behind last Friday's terrorist attack, targeting worshippers at a packed mosque in the northern Afghan city of Kunduz. Ayatollah Khamenei wrote in a message on Saturday, 9th of October, the bitter tragic incident involving a blast at a mosque in Khanabad district of Kunduz province, which resulted in the death of a large number of people of faithful worshippers, saddened us. He added, authorities in the neighboring and brotherly country of Afghanistan are seriously expected to punish the bloodthirsty perpetrators of this heinous crime and take all the necessary steps to prevent a recurrence of such a tragedy. The leader of the Islamic Revolution also asked God to bestow mercy and the highest heavenly blessings upon the souls of the martyrs of this incident, and prayed for the immediate recovery of all those wounded. Meanwhile, Iran's president, Sayed Ebrahim Raisi, has voiced his concerns about the persistence of terrorist attacks in neighboring Afghanistan, saying it is no secret that the growth of Daesh terrorist group, which claimed responsibility for the latest atrocity in Afghanistan, was an American job. In a message released on Saturday, 9th of October, President Ebrahim Raisi expressed his condolences to the people of Afghanistan and the entire human society over the martyring and injuring of a large number of innocent Afghans whilst they were praying in a sacred place. President Raisi said, "It is no secret to anyone that the growth of this Takfiri terrorist movement has taken place with the full support of the United States." President Raisi added, "In recent years, the United States has facilitated further activities of Daesh criminal terrorists in Afghanistan and prevented their eradication." Furthermore, the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament, Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf, also expressed his condolences to the Afghan nation and all those who lost their loved ones in the latest terrorist atrocity, while calling on Afghanistan's new authorities to act decisively against the culprits of this horrendous attack and to prevent the recurrence of such painful atrocities in the future. Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf wrote in his message, "The criminal hand of the foolish terrorists was once again stained with the blood of the oppressed worshippers in line with the anti-Islam bigotry and Islamophobia." Criticizing those who often claim to champion human rights over their silence in the face of this terrorist attack, the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament also said the international community is expected to forthrightly condemn such tragedy, introduce the already infamous sponsors of terrorists, and commit them for trial. Also, Samira Hamidi, a human rights activist, said the Qunduz attack is a reminder that terrorism is at its peak in Afghanistan, warning against ignoring the dangers posed by the Takfiri terrorist group Daesh. Munazza Ebtekar, an Afghan researcher at Oxford University in England, said there are no feelings of sadness or desperation, just anger, asserting that the murderous campaign to kill the Hazara population can and will be stopped by the people of Afghanistan. Pertinently, it is not the first attack on the minority Hazara community in Afghanistan claimed by the Daesh terrorists. The targeted attack has assumed alarming proportions since 2014, when Daesh terrorists made a foray into Afghanistan from their original bases in Syria. The attacks on Ziyarat-e-Sakhi Shrine in western Kabul in 2015, Bagharul Ulum Masjid, or the Bagharul Ulum Mosque in central Kabul in 2015, the Al-Zahra Mosque and Imam Zaman Mosque in western Kabul in 2017, Hazara Educational Center in 2018, are just some of the examples of ghastly terror attacks perpetrated by the Daesh terrorist group in recent years. More recently, in May of this year, three bombs struck outside a girls' school in western Kabul's Hazara-dominated neighborhood of Dasht-e-Barchi, leaving at least 68 people martyred. The victims were all young girls with big dreams. The pattern of attack remains the same, but now a different set of players are running the show in Kabul. Will the Taliban, which has its rivalry with the Daesh terrorists, up its game to protect the vulnerable Hazara community, or will we see the repeat of the late 1890s? Time will tell.
Stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say I am a Muslim. If you ask her why does she dress that way, all covered up in she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic law.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Deen al-Islam, deen al-Arab, ghayr deen Muhammad al-Hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about Nazr, or giving food and charity to the poor and the like, according to the fatwas of Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid, according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij in his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Javid, we are talking about laws related to vows or nazr according to Ayatollah Khamenei, And let me start off this episode with this question. If a person pledges a vow that he will offer a certain prayer like hajat or wish prayer for 14 days, for Fridays, for example.
Yes.
And but he leaves the end like open-ended,
yes.
Okay? And doesn't fix any time or imposes any time on it. Can he start to fulfill his promise or vow at any time?
Yes, that's a good question. You know, if you do not fix the vow, and you make it you make a kind of unrestricted vow, you know, we have restricted to time and space, and we have unrestricted vow, you know, in a categorical absolute way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, again, the vow is valid, and of course it has to be fulfilled, but the time is extended, and the person who makes that pledge is actually allowed to delay it until such time when he has no time left. For example, mm-hmm. if a person, let's say, makes just as you mentioned, an open-ended vow, he has to comply with that vow when he sees the signs of death, approaching death, because it is it's not fixed, it's not limited to time and space, so he can do it any time in his life, okay? And when he sees the sign of approaching death, then he has to do it, otherwise he has sinned, and he has to pay kafara, because he should not delay it until such time when he is actually incapacitated, is unable to comply with it.
I see. Sheikh Chavid, you know, most of the rituals, if not all, have certain conditions,
yeah,
through which and with which you can say that they are met. Like, those conditions should be met. And if they are not actualized, if they are not materialized, then that ritual is not considered to be valid.
Sure.
All right?
Yes.
What if somebody makes a vow that he will smoke, for example, cigarette, or he will not go out to work? Mm-hmm. Is his vow valid?
Well, one of the most important conditions concerning vow is that the thing that we pledge to do must be a preferred action, and it must be a recommended action or a wajib act. Okay, if the thing that you pledge to do is neither recommended nor wajib, and it's neither preferable in the eye of Islamic Sharia, of course. Not in the eye of an ordinary person, okay? Because different people have different likes and dislikes,
yes.
Okay? In the eye of Sharia, if something is not preferred, it's not going to be binding, okay?
Yes.
Now, let alone something which is, of course, not preferred, which,
yes,
is abominable, like for example, smoking cigarette, which is haram according to some religious authority, and which is makruh according to some others, okay,
mm-hmm.
depending on the amount of let's say harm or damage that it might cause, and it might inflict on your health, okay.
Yes.
So the vow which is made about smoking cigarette, if a person makes a vow and says, okay, I'm going to smoke cigarette for 10 days, it is the vow is not binding. Or if a person says that I'm going to avoid working or going to job, or not, I will not do any job,
yes,
and earn money for my family, it's not binding, because it's not preferred. It is even you know, makruh, to haram even to,
yes,
to smoke cigarette, or
okay,
to stop doing something for your family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is a hadith which says, Al-Qadu li'ayalik al-mujahidi fi sabilillah. A person who works for his family and who earns for his family is like a mujahid who is fighting in the way,
yes,
of Allah.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Sheikh Javid, we are talking about the laws of vow or nazr according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And let me ask you this interesting question. Is the vow of a young, immature, non-adult boy valid? Like an underage or something, all right?
Right.
What if he makes a vow out of excitement? Is his vow binding?
That's a good question. Well, the religious authorities, including Supreme Leader Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, have stated that in order for a nazr to be binding, the person who makes that vow or the pledge, in fact, must be adult. Okay.
Yes.
The nazr which is made by a non-adult or by an underage child actually is not valid. And of course, an underage child or an underage must actually get his father's permission, because
to make a vow.
Yeah, to make a vow, because he cannot use his property or his asset or whatever he has without his father's permission. His father is his guardian, and therefore his consent must be obtained.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when it comes to excitement, of course, excitement, it may be a person who is adult, a person who is who has reached the age of puberty.
Yes.
Makes a vow out of pure excitement. Again, the religious authorities have said that such a vow is not binding, because he was not
in a right state of mind.
Yeah, of course, he was not in a proper state of mind,
mm-hmm.
and therefore his decision, the decision that he made, is not binding. The vow is not going to be wajib, and he does not have to comply with it.
I see. But what about a feeble-minded person or a bankrupt, for example, pledging a vow?
Yeah.
Are their vows binding or valid?
Again, it has something to do with a person's having the capacity to make a vow. Okay, a feeble-minded person is a person who does not distinguish his best interest. He does not understand. He is not in a position to tell the difference between good and bad. Okay.
Yes.
So his mind does not function properly,
mm-hmm.
and therefore whatever decisions made by him are not enforced. They are not valid. Okay. It does not make any difference whether the feeble-minded person makes a vow, or he takes an oath, or he gives a loan, or he carries out a transaction. Whatever is done, whatever anything that is done by a feeble-minded person is not considered valid in the eye of Islamic Sharia. Now, when it comes to a bankrupt is a person who is not solvent. He is insolvent, and he is not able to repay his loan. He is, of course, he owes other people a lot of money. And according to Islamic Sharia, a bankrupt does not have the right of discretion over his property. And it is a religious authority, in fact, who takes control of his property and actually repays his loan, and of course and uses his property to pay off his debt. Okay, so whether we use the word bankrupt or an insolvent person, of course, I think the best word to use is insolvent.
Mm-hmm.
So, and a person who is not able to repay his loan does not have the right to the right to use his property. He has no right of discretion over his property.
Okay.
And therefore, if he makes a vow, his vow is not also binding.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Britain grapples with a full-blown crisis. Labor shortages, truck drivers in particular, have disrupted supply chain activities and caused several problems. The significant lack of drivers meant deliveries of fuel and food were falling short. As a result, the country witnessed panic buying of fuel and some goods dwindled. These events triggered chaotic scenes across major cities. leading to long lines at gas stations and fistfights among drivers. Also, many factories and businesses are struggling with rising energy bills. They are on the verge of halting production and closing down unless the government immediately acts on spiraling natural gas prices. In fact, the crisis has already forced a wave of collapses among energy suppliers. This is while the government is planning to impose a levy on gas bills, which could push the prices further. The British government is now under fire for its handling of the crisis. So, being under intense pressure, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson blamed the trucking industry for Britain's supply chain mess. The industry called Johnson's claims wrong and pointed to the government's immigration policy and delays in testing and certifying new drivers as the main culprits. The government also claimed there is a global shortage of drivers. However, the European countries have not faced a similar problem. Britain faces a shortfall of 100,000 drivers. 20% of those are drivers who departed Britain after the country voted to leave the European Union. In addition, about 200,000 EU citizens left Britain during the coronavirus pandemic. So, how does the British government address the crisis? By introducing a short-term visa program. But by offering short-term visas to foreign truckers, the British government is admitting that exiting the EU was a decisive factor in the current crisis. In addition, many people are reluctant to uproot themselves and move to Britain for temporary and difficult work while they have better options in EU member state countries.
It's a crisis of the free market, a triumph of the free market. The government abandoned regulation, it abandoned public ownership, so it's private ownership. So we're depending for energy in Britain on people who make lots of profits out of energy shortages. So, you know, if it's to someone's advantage to see gas and electricity prices shoot up, then they're going to go up. They're not going to say, oh, we're not going to take profits because it's bad for the economy. They're going to say, hey, send me more.
Households that spend a high proportion of their income on energy bills are considered to be in fuel poverty. Currently, 4 million people in Britain are already in fuel poverty, while up to 1.5 additional British households won't be able to afford to heat and power their homes. Last October, the government raised the energy price cap to control the sharply rising wholesale gas prices. The cap limits the impact of soaring energy prices on British households. The UK energy regulator said that the price cap must rise again next year if wholesale gas prices continue to go up. This could mean a typical customer paying between £400 and £600 more annually. That's while natural gas prices are at record highs as economies around the world begin to recover from the COVID crisis.
The government in Britain has recently cut back on the minimum payments for welfare and support for all sorts of people, from unemployed to underpaid to pensioners. So a lot of the apparatus that was very leaky, the very leaky safety net we already had in Britain has been torn up, and the government has decided that people, as a matter of conscious policy, they think that people only go to work if they're starving, so they're trying to starve people, and that includes freezing them. Freezing and starving will get them to work is what they think.
The price rises have already pushed 500,000 more households into fuel poverty. Unable to pay heating and energy costs, these low-income families are at a great risk. Many actually die every year because they can't afford to heat their homes. In fact, 8,500 people died in England and Wales last winter due to cold homes. All in all, the British government should stop blaming others and start cleaning up the mess it is responsible for.
In another sign of growing tensions in ties between Washington and Beijing, the United States Central Intelligence Agency announced the formation of a group that would focus exclusively on China. The CIA argued in a statement that the China Mission Center aims at addressing what it called global challenges to the U.S. competitiveness posed by the People's Republic of China. According to the U.S. spy agency, those issues include emerging technologies, economic security, climate change, and health.
The real threat that China poses that the United States is referring to is the ability to undermine the empire. And when we see that right now, that there's definitely a global shift going on, which is starting to move from the West towards the East, of which China is the main power in this situation.
The announcement comes amid a wider prioritization by the administration of President Joe Biden on countering Beijing. In June, Biden announced a new task force at the Pentagon to assess and respond to Beijing's military challenge. The United States and China remain at odds over several issues, including the situation in Hong Kong, U.S. relations with Taiwan, trade, commerce, and the disputed South China Sea. U.S. President Joe Biden has repeatedly vowed to re-engage with the international community, marking a departure from his predecessor Donald Trump's foreign policy. In the case of China, however, it appears that he's following in the footsteps of Donald Trump's America First stance against Beijing. Top U.S. counterintelligence officials have reportedly warned that a concerning number of CIA informants are being captured and executed. According to the New York Times, the warning came in a top-secret memo the officials issued to all of the CIA stations and bases around the world last week. The memo suggests that the agency's counterintelligence mission center looked at dozens of cases in the last several years involving foreign informants who had been killed, arrested, or most likely compromised. The cable itself was not necessarily unique, but as the Times notes, announcing the specific number of killings is rare, as the information is usually kept strictly under wraps by intelligence officials.
And this has been something that was significant enough that it was leaked into the mainstream media where it was reported on. It seems the United States sees this as possibly a potential crisis and something they need to reinforce with more bodies.
According to the Times, recruiting spies has always been highly risky. However, the cable warned that the CIA has not excelled in the area recently for reasons that include being too trusting of sources, underestimating foreign intelligence agencies, and moving too quickly to recruit informants while ignoring potential risks.
It's frankly acknowledged that everybody is spying on everybody else because everybody needs to know what their competitor is doing with regards to their stance towards them and what plans they have, etc. So in this regards, the United States is not doing anything new, nothing that it has ever done before. But the main bulwark of this, the main reason this is happening, is the U.S. is trying to expand its current intelligence network.
The report says that the uptick in the compromised informants highlights the growing prowess of other countries in employing innovations like biometric scans, facial recognition, artificial intelligence, and hacking tools to track the movements of CIA officers in order to discover the sources. The memo suggested that the U.S. spy agency overestimated its capacities and underestimated its adversaries. The results show that countries targeted by U.S. espionage are becoming more capable of exposing agents than ever before.
U.S. social media giant has come under scathing attack by a former employee. The company has been accused of putting profit over everything else. Former Facebook employee Frances Hogan says that the company's sites and apps are harmful for children. She has also accused the social media platform of stoking divisions in society. 37-year-old Hogan was previously a product manager at the company. Now she's a whistleblower and has turned against Facebook. She made the accusation at a hearing in the Senate. Hogan accused Facebook of putting profit over safety and compared it to tobacco companies, arguing that a company with such frightening influence over so many people, over their deepest thoughts, feelings, and behavior, needs real oversight. She also said that if left alone, Facebook will continue to make choices that go against the common good.
If you look at the way that they filter content, if you look at the way that they censor certain topics that they'd rather not be seen, the way that they quote-unquote fact-check some of the things, the way that they delete accounts without discretion, the way that they censor people, and the way that they choose what content goes at the top of your newsfeed or shows up on your newsfeed at all through their algorithm, they really have a grip on what it is we are able to see on Facebook.
The context for the hearing were materials that she had leaked to the Wall Street Journal. According to the documents, Facebook's own studies suggest that Instagram and social media in general have a negative psychological effect on young girls. She also accused Facebook's CEO, Zuckerberg, of having too much power and bringing up the January 6th Capitol riot.
Facebook wants you to believe that the problems we're talking about are unsolvable. They want you to believe in false choices. They want you to believe that you must choose between a Facebook full of divisive and extreme content or losing one of the most important values our country was founded upon, free speech. That you must choose between public oversight of Facebook's choices and your personal privacy. That to be able to share fun photos of your kids with old friends, you must also be inundated with anger-driven virality. They want you to believe that this is just part of the deal.
Facebook has faced growing scrutiny and increasing calls for its regulation. Founder Mark Zuckerberg hit back, saying the latest accusations were at odds with the company's goals. In a letter to the staff, he said that many of the claims were illogical and pointed to Facebook's efforts to fight harmful content. The CEO argued that while Facebook took the initiative to create a massive research project to identify and solve certain problems, critics are merely weaponizing that work against the company to create a false narrative. Responding to Hogan's claims that Facebook's attempts to limit harmful content were constantly hampered by a shortage of staff, he said, "If we did not care about fighting harmful content, then why would we employ so many more people dedicated to this than any other company in our space, even ones larger than us?" Facebook is the world's most popular social media site. The company says it has 2.7 billion monthly active users.
So I think overall it's very detrimental to democracy because of the flow of information that is so tightly controlled through Facebook. And also think it shows, much like tobacco companies in the past or vape companies, that they've targeted children who are in very crucial developmental stages in their lives in order to get new customers, as noted in the testimony before the Senate.
Hundreds of millions of people also use the company's other products, including WhatsApp and Instagram, but it has been criticized on several fronts, from failing to protect users' privacy to not doing enough to halt the spread of disinformation.
Facebook, as I said, can truly decide what shows up in your newsfeed, what gets attention, what is put in the spotlight, and what is suppressed. And I think that's a big problem. It doesn't matter who you're friends with or who you like or the groups you're in, etc. They can filter stuff out through including certain ads. They can bury stuff in their algorithms. They can ban or censor or suspend accounts that may or may not go against the terms of service. Sometimes it's not so clear whether or not certain users go against terms of service, but find themselves banned or suspended anyway.
The accusations against the social media giant came amid a worldwide outage of the company's platforms. The social media services went down for almost 6 hours, impacting more than 3.5 billion users worldwide. The global outage and the revelations seriously harmed the media giant's status in the world as a reliable media platform.
The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, led by the United States, has long been on a confrontational course with Russia. Developments on the ground on Russia's western borders and elsewhere are pointing to increasing tensions between the two sides. The Western Alliance has been moving military hardware and ground forces to Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Poland. The situation in Ukraine has turned into another serious bone of contention. NATO and Russia have been flexing their military muscles. The two have shown through their military drills and deployments, as well as public statements, that they are serious about pursuing their geopolitical interests in the Baltic region, the Middle East, and even in the Arctic. Meanwhile, America's ongoing efforts to complete a comprehensive missile system in Europe have further worried Moscow. Radars, warships, and long-range missile interceptors placed across Europe form components of the controversial system.
Without the Soviet Union, NATO does not need to exist, and they are clinging for dear life. They're trying to justify to create a reason for them to be there and to continue to exist. And that's why they're constantly provoking Russia when Russia is not the Soviet Union. They are not the threat that the Soviet Union was.
As NATO expands eastward, Russia is not sitting idly by. It has adopted a set of countermeasures. For instance, Russia has used its westernmost territory, Kaliningrad, as a platform to boost its defenses. The territory is located between Poland and Lithuania on the Baltic Sea. Moscow has deployed the Iskander missiles and its S-400 air defense systems in Kaliningrad. NATO and Moscow have maintained contacts to try to minimize risks. The Russian Federation has had an observer mission to the Western Alliance. It was meant to promote cooperation in common security areas. This week, tensions between the two sides escalated once again after NATO expelled some members of the Russian mission. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said that the organization expelled the 8 Russian diplomats over a rise in, quote, malign activities by Moscow. The Russian government was quick to slam NATO's decision. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said that there is an obvious inconsistency in statements by NATO representatives about their desire to normalize relations with Russia and in their actual actions. He added that such actions allow Moscow not to develop illusions about the normalization of relations. Meanwhile, chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the lower house of the Russian parliament, Leonid Slutsky, warned of asymmetric retaliatory measures. How will this latest episode of tensions between the two sides play out? NATO's relations with Moscow have largely been tied to the policies of the United States. Former U.S. President Donald Trump was usually accused of being too soft on Russia, but Joe Biden has made it clear that his administration will be tough on Moscow. In his first 100 days in office, Biden imposed 2 new sets of sanctions on Moscow and expelled nearly a dozen Russian diplomats from the U.S. Biden has repeated accusations of interference in U.S. elections and cyber attacks on government and businesses against Russia. Washington and Moscow are also locked in a dispute over embassy staffing, which could further sour their ties. Analysts believe that the rivalry between the Russian Federation and the West, including NATO, is too deep-rooted to be solved in any foreseeable future.
In the limelight.
Guatemalan police rescued 126 mainly Haitian migrants from an abandoned shipping container on the side of a road on Saturday, 9th of October, highlighting how the desperate flow of people from Haiti and across South America has not abated despite the recent wave of U.S. deportations. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Washington Post journalist Miriam Berger. The piece is titled, More Than 100 Haitians Found in Trailer in Guatemala as Desperate Efforts to Reach United States Continue. Guatemalan police have rescued 126 mainly Haitian migrants from an abandoned shipping container on the side of a road on Saturday, 9th of October, highlighting how the desperate flow of people from Haiti and across South America has not abated despite the recent wave of United States deportations. Guatemalan authorities said they searched the trailer around dawn after residents heard screams coming from within. The shipping container was found in an area between the towns of Nueva Concepcion and Cocales in the country's south. Guatemalan police spokesman Jorge Aguilar told reporters that of the 126 undocumented people found inside the shipping container 106 were from Haiti, 11 were from Nepal, and 9 were from Ghana, according to an Agence France-Presse report. Guatemalan police suspect that they had paid to be illegally taken to the United States via Mexico by smugglers, who instead abandoned them on the road in southern Guatemala. The treacherous journey appears to have begun in Honduras, said a spokeswoman for Guatemala's Migration Authority, Alejandra Mena. After first aid checks on the migrants and asylum seekers, Guatemalan officials said they would be deported back to Honduras and taken into custody there. Countless migrants and asylum seekers have died or been detained while taking increasingly risky routes to reach the United States. On Thursday, 7th of October, police in Mexico found 652 migrants crammed into 6 trailers near Mexico's border with the United States. About half of them were children, nearly 200 of whom were not accompanied by any adult. Refugee advocates have been particularly concerned about a recent surge of migrants from Haiti, the Western Hemisphere's poorest nation, that's now also facing the world's highest per capita kidnapping rate. Warring gangs already controlled significant parts of the country when President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated in July of this year, thrusting the country into further political turmoil. The Biden administration has since backed Haiti's embattled interim prime minister, Ariel Henry, who critics say would be unable to remain in power without Washington's support. Adding to the daily stress of Haitians, a 7.2 magnitude earthquake in August devastated much of the island nation's southwest. Facing increasingly dire conditions at home in Haiti and in South American countries where many Haitians fled after the 2010 earthquake, thousands of Haitian migrants have tried their luck seeking asylum and seeking work in the United States. Many of those who came in recent months said they expected to be allowed in by the Biden administration. But amid a surge at the U.S.-Mexico border, the Biden administration in mid-September began rapidly deporting thousands of Haitians from Texas to Port-au-Prince in Haiti. Some who were sent back said they had not lived in Haiti for decades. Others vowed to continue to try again to enter the United States. The Biden administration invoked a pandemic-related measure, Title 42, to rapidly deport border crossers back to Mexico, to their home countries. Deportees, however, said no systematic coronavirus testing has been conducted, and several reported testing positive for the virus upon arrival in Haiti. Controversy erupted last month after images of horse-mounted border patrol agents attempting to grab migrants and push them back over the border into Mexico put the nation's focus on the unfolding humanitarian crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border. Once back in Haiti, some recent returnees have become the targets of kidnappers amid reports that they will be carrying cash. Many of the thousands of Haitians deported in recent weeks remain stranded in Port-au-Prince. Ambassador Daniel Foote, President Biden's former special envoy for Haiti, resigned last month in protest over the U.S. government's policies towards Haitian migrants. Former Ambassador Daniel Foote told members of a House panel on Thursday that the deportation policies were inhumane and would not deter people from trying to reach the United States. Daniel Foote said, "We've always prioritized stability over going after the root causes of instability." Foote told lawmakers. He added, "I believe the root causes of instability are now that the Haitian people do not believe that they have had a voice in their destiny in selecting their leaders."